The sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. When I was in Malaysia, I realized that people can do a vigorous sadhu. The Malaysians were great, like, 100 people and finish your talk and the whole auditorium is just resounding with sadhu. It's a kind of Buddhist way of acknowledging something. And sometimes we want to do that, don't we? But we don't have a... Well, you could applaud, but then I'd be embarrassed. So, developing some kind of ritual around that. I went to the holy places. When was it? A year and a half ago, maybe. But I was. I went to the Sarnath Temple in India, and I was. I went quite early, so I got in there just as the doors were opening. And I was sitting there, and then I was one of the first in. And then I could hear people coming in. I just kept meditating, coming in, a lot of people coming in. And then all of a sudden, sadhu, 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 sadhu. And this went on for about 20 minutes. And just kind of, and I couldn't resist, and I looked and what was going on. And it was a group of Sri Lankan pilgrims. There must have been 200. And they had done up these beautiful bouquets of, or platters of flowers as offerings to the main shrine. And as someone would offer one of these platters to the main shrine, the whole 200 would go, sadhu, 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 sadhu. It's a lovely sound. And those devotional aspects of traditional Buddhism, we come across those pretty slowly as Westerners, because we enter Buddhism from a different avenue, usually through mindfulness and those kind of practices, or from the intellect, things like that. And then when you go to, well, like if you've ever been near His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and you see the devotional energy around him, or you go to the temples in Malaysia or Sri Lanka or Thailand, there is this beautiful bhakti quality in the way people relate to their teachers and to their places, to their places of pilgrimage. I suspect Westerners who are very inclined to that might kind of be inclined more to Tibetan Buddhism, I don't know. But it is, there is like, the way we develop the spiritual life very much depends on different characters and different preferences. And there's a... I sometimes talk about a friend I had in New Zealand, and on his mantle he had a picture of Mother Teresa, Ajahn Chah, Sri Ramana Maharshi, and what's his name from Calcutta, the great Shivananda, Ramakrishna, right? So he had these four pictures, and he kind of pointed to Mother Teresa, and he says she's a karma yogi, and so her path was service. And you probably know the story where someone says to Mother Teresa, how wonderful it is that she set up the leprosariums and the orphanages for the poor people of India. And she said, well, I didn't set it up for the poor people of India, I set it up for the nuns so that they could practice karma yoga. I mean, whoa, okay. Different kind of practice. So there is that. There is that type of practice and type, and in all of us, I think service and self-sacrifice are a very important part of this life. When we talk about generosity, sometimes in Western talk of it, you don't hear the word self-sacrifice that much. You hear it a lot more in the Thai discourses on the cultivation of generosity. They would say dana and what's the Thai word? I forget what the Thai word is, but generosity and self-sacrifice, that would be quite often you'd hear that. So there is that in us and in as a part of the spiritual life. Then Ramakrishna? That was Ramakrishna, was it, right? From Calcutta, the great saint, yeah? I don't know if you've ever read about him. He was kind of born in the late 19th century, and he was the most... There's a writer called Les Hickson who wrote a book called Great Swan, and it's a beautiful description of Ramakrishna's life. And Ramakrishna was a bhakta. He was among the many paths that he could practice. He was very much into the devotional kind of quality, and devotion in a way that which is unfathomable for me. Really, it was just so. He must have been a marvelous being to be with. So my friend would say that's the practice of bhakti, the practice of devotion, and you see that in the religious life where people are very devoted to a guru or a teacher and like just totally surrender to that and it's kind of the way of the heart. And then he put into Ajahn Chah and Sri Ramana, and he said that's the Janani Yoga, that's the way of wisdom. This is the way of reflection and the way of awareness. And all three, I think, are in all ways. I mean, you have all three, but our particular way is the way of wisdom. And the way of wisdom is not necessarily the way of intellect. It's not the intellect, but it's not just the intellect. The way of the danger with intellect is you think you know something, but you just have information, and no amount of information really is it. And that's one of the dangers of being overly acquisitive of information, where we can, because Theravada has a wonderful intellectual structures, and you can learn a lot, you can study a lot, and that, if one was an academic, would be necessary part, but just to always acquire more information would leave us at the level of thought. Thought is important, right? Thought is important. But just this practice of the heart, which I was suggesting today, you can't think your way into that, can you? You can use thought as a suggestion, but to actually touch something in you which is connected and empathetic and so on is more than just an idea. So the way of wisdom is the way of reflection. And the reflection and the capacity to reflect is, like, wisdom is quite often the way I was taught from Ajahn Sumedho. Wisdom isn't it's a faculty rather than a bunch of stuff you know. It's something you use. It's an active thing. So wisdom or clear comprehension is the capacity to really know this moment. And then to begin to reflect on cause and effect, to watch cause and effect, to try things out, to experiment, see how that works, and from that experimenting and watching to see what is it that leads to suffering and what leads to the end of suffering, which is different than just accumulating, having an opinion about something. Say in sometimes you can see in different. I can see even in our communities of monastic communities, different monasteries will have different kind of conceits about, you know, their teacher's better or their particular take on it is more original, or that, you know, this is really what the Buddha taught. Whenever I see that, when I said someone writes a book, what the Buddha really taught, I think, oh yeah, here we go. So there's a tendency to make judgments with intellect of other practitioners, or kind of get limited by intellect. When you suffer, you suffer. You know, when you suffer, you suffer. So one of the downfalls of intellect is the attachment to idealism. You know, we can have ideals of compassion, or ideals of attainment, or ideals of whatever you want, but those are just ideals. You know, they're constructs of mind, of how I should be, how you should be, how Buddhism should be. And those things, when we don't see them as simply that, as ideas in the mind, and we attach to them, then it gets very difficult because we're not using wisdom now. We're using a kind of critical, judgmental, attached aspect of intellect. So I might have an ideal of being somehow always mindful or always kind or always generous, and then when it doesn't come up like that, my attachment to thought, to ideals, then makes me become self-judgmental, and that doesn't really work. Whereas the reflective capacity knows an ideal is an ideal. You know, life, like you should be this way, or I should be this way is a thought. Life should be some way, but life is this way. So once you start to introduce that practice into ordinary life, as well as retreat, and life is this way, just this way, then you can see what you're creating around it. That one wants something else, or one doesn't want to be here, or one seeks a distraction, or one is blaming, or one sees the complexity that's being created around the way things are. And it's obviously very helpful. And also, as one awakens to the way things are, just the way things are, one begins to have better choices. You begin to have choices which come from a kind of freedom of mind. Even if the situation is very painful, you still have more freedom to make some kind of a choice which comes from the place of wisdom rather than the place of ideals. So right thought is important. And right thought stems from right understanding. And right understanding, sometimes we see that in right understanding is somehow that if I study enough, I'm going to get right understanding, and then I'll start to think rightly. So we study and study and study and study. But right understanding, in one way of looking at it, is, well, this is the way it is now. Right? It's just this way. I understand this now. And that, there's no way you can describe this moment. I can describe it. But for each of us, this moment is different. And to come to that satisampajanya, or clear comprehension, this way it is now, one has to let go of thought. One has to come into the present moment and just let it be the way it is. And if I've avoided the way it is, or my mind tends to think all the time or get distracted, then that's not so straightforward. It's not so straightforward. So this is the basis of wisdom practice, the basis of that, what I think Lobo Cha was teaching us. In Thai, they say puru, or like buto. They use the word Buddha in the vocative. So they, with the breathing, they'll say buto, buto. So that'll be a mantra they'll use for calming the mind. Or they also say, be the Buddha, pen puru. Know, be the knowing. Be the knowing, know the way things are. Now, people who take that intellectually, like I remember once talking like this to someone, say, the Buddha taught the truth of the way things are. And this lady put up her hand, whose truth? No, you don't get it. Because it's not a written truth, like the Pali truth or the Tibetan truth. The truth of the way things now is, what do I say, right? It busts, you can't say anything. It says this way. And that truth is Dharma. That's what we mean by Dharma. Now, we have the conceptual constructs of the teaching, certainly. That's laid out for us. But what are those ideas pointing to? You know, what are they pointing to? The imagery that, say, I was suggesting yesterday. Was it yesterday? Yeah, I think so. The image of the wheel, the image of awareness including everything, and the bicycle, kind of having balance. Well, if you take the image of the wheel, and you take that, and you begin to kind of really practice with it, and say, so if I'm looking at that fan, getting dizzy, but I'm looking at that fan, the fan's going around, and I contemplate, this is the way it is now, my mind goes silent because I'm curious about what is it that knows. Now, if I'm curious about the fan, because let's say like we're building a new building. Oh, I wonder where they got that. Home Depot? Right? It looks a bit cheap. I don't know. I want a better one. Then I'm out into the rim, right? I'm making ascetic judgments and so on. So most of our time is spent out, much of our time is spent out in the rim. So this is a kind of, well, what is it that knows that? And all I can't find the knowing. I can only be that, right? So then do that with a person, say, you know, you kind of, someone is talking to you, and you're not being rude, don't worry about it. and let the person come into consciousness and make them conscious. What is it that knows that? You don't say that to them, they'll feel offended. But just, what is it that knows that? Do that with someone who's angry at you, now that's tough. You know, someone who's exhibiting distress towards you. And what is it that feels that? You begin to see that even that, like being threatened by someone, although one has to be protective and so on, even that, there is the knowing. There is the knowing. So that's why it's a refuge. That's why we can say, Buddhang sarang gacchami, Dhammang sarang gacchami. So when I know the way things are, that particular way of being, way of operating, whatever you want to use, is truly a refuge because it's always accessible. Whereas aesthetics, people, health, weather, it's uncertain, you don't know. That. And so the emphasis on uncertainty is not an end in itself. Like it's just saying, well, don't rely on the uncertain, but take refuge in the certain. And so if I'm always just looking at that which is changing, right, my mind is still out into the objects, but that which knows change, then I come back to that sense of presence, which is refuge. So Buddhang Sarang Gacchami, Dhammang Sarang Gacchami is something that we do as Buddhists, and people parrot it out sometimes, but it's actually got a very profound meaning. It's very, very, but very subtle. It's very subtle. Because when you say it in a conventional, say, Buddhang Sarang Gacchami in a conventional sense, Dhammang Sarang Gacchami, then, well, it's the Buddha 2,500 plus years ago, and then it's the Dharma, whose Dharma? Oh, Tibetan Dharma, and so on and so forth. But closer to home, that the Dharma is the way things are now. So why do we emphasize change? And why do we emphasize suffering and craving? Well, because craving is the kind of energy which, if we don't understand it, it takes us out to the rim. And craving is particularly described in terms of ignorance. So we have desire. We all have desire. We come here because we want to be peaceful. We have a spiritual aspiration. That's a good, wholesome desire, isn't it? That's a good, which we'd say wholesome desire. But there's unwholesome, unskillful desires are always combined with ignorance. And ignorance is that which sees permanence in that which is impermanent. And one of the ways we talk about ignorance. So when my attention is always out into sense experience, into trying to get some kind of sense experience, that very much going out away from my real home, away from refuge, is itself the problem. That's a kind of misunderstanding. Whereas when I see that the object indicates this pure knowing, all objects, then when craving arises, the object of my experience comes up, let's say, I feel a stomach ache. Right? So I feel a stomach ache and it's unpleasant. And I have to do something about it and I take some pills or whatever. And then having done all the medical things I can do, let's say I'm hypochondriacal. Nice word, hypochondriacal. Then the stomach ache leads to what? Google. Right? My gosh, I've got brain cancer. No, it's in the stomach, sorry. And so then It's a facetious example, but that, you know, the craving to not have the sickness and the habit of craving for a hypochondriac then leads one into worry and over-evaluation and da-da-da-da and more Google sites, and then you find more sites which agree with it, and the mind's a mess. And what's happened is that craving has arisen with the stomach ache, and that craving, rather than see, oh, this is craving, craving feels this way. Now, I, you know, having done what has to be done in terms of medicine, having done that, say a person who isn't a hypochondriac, say, who hasn't got a problem, they see worry come up, and they, oh, worry feels this way. You've done what you had to do, yep, saw the doctor, okay. And then worry points back to the center. So you take refuge in knowing worry as a changing condition, rather than taking refuge in worry and becoming reborn in worry. So one takes you in, and the other takes you out. And you're just like on one of those, going right. That's samsara, the endless round of rebirth, coming and going, coming and going. I mean, and craving is a powerful, powerful, powerful energy. You know, it's the energy of birth. And so, like say I was saying, when I was kind of down, when my mother died, that kind of really down feeling, like, I was, you know, I had enough experience to say I didn't have to fix it. But you could see some people around thought they had to fix it around because they were worried, because I'm usually pretty jovial. But I just wasn't jovial. But so then, oh, there's something wrong, we have to fix it. You know, you can't be down. But that's not always very helpful, because sometimes that leads to, I mean, it can be helpful sometimes, but sometimes it doesn't allow something to actually get processed. And so sometimes we don't let things cease. We don't let them in. We kind of get in there trying to fix them, try to get rid of them, try to make them better or different. And that's why sometimes they just keep mulling around in mind. But to just witness to something which is difficult and say, no, it's just changing. This will change. It's just this way. Take refuge, you take refuge. And then oftentimes, and you really see something change, and there's a profound silence afterwards. That's not uncommon. So this is a wisdom practice in that way. Wisdom as Ajahn Sumedho uses it, sometimes he calls it intuitive awareness, which is a kind of difficult translation, but you can see how it's not like, it's a kind of intuition you have, that it's an inward kind of thing, you know, it's just this way. And to trust in that. So you really have to trust in that. But our habit might be to trust in analysis, which isn't wrong. I'm not saying it's wrong, but sometimes it can be overdone. We just cannot leave it alone. We have to keep fixing it or figuring it out or trying to draw conclusions from it. And it's just this way. It's just this way now. And the right and the wrong. And the more I think that, the more I do that, I know where I can use thought, but the more I see the very desire for certainty is another kind of condition. The thing about attachment to intellect is that, now I've seen this in people who are very, like you find someone who can be very, very opinionated, right? Very strong opinions about things, which you're kind of surprised. Wow, you got an opinion about that, huh? But then when their structures of opinion are somehow taken away, they're like jello without the bowl. Well, I don't know, uncertainty. And I said, well, that's interesting. And I could see that kind of person, they attach the certainty through an opinion, right? That feels really good, I'm certain this is really the way it is. But then ambiguity comes up, paradox, uncertainty, and they kind of, gotta nail it down. And yet, certainty and uncertainty are just conditions, right? They're just intellectual certainty. You know. So I get that a lot, and people ask me a question, beats me, I don't know. And that's so great as a teacher to say, you don't know, isn't it? Whereas before, I felt very threatened by someone if they asked me a clever question and I had a stupid answer. And then I feel really, oh, I should know something. So it took me a while to say, oh, this is just uncertainty. Uncertainty feels this way. So even that, like a position, intellectual certainty, it's fine if it's there, But then the kind of conceit of opinion. So you find people who are very opinionated quite often can be very conceited in their opinions. And it can be very offensive, in fact, can't it? We've all seen that. Not that you can't have opinions. So then in Buddhism, oh, I shouldn't have any opinions. But that's another position, right? I'm someone who shouldn't have opinions. No, opinion is an opinion. You have an opinion. It feels this way. And then you don't have an opinion. It feels that way. You feel certain. You don't feel certain. You know, you begin to see this movement of thought and emotion and you know, that is a movement. But what is it that doesn't move? Where's that? And that's always there. That's always there. It's always present. Now, like, conscious presence is actually always there. And because we identify with the rim so much, we identify with thought and self, we think, you know, we think we haven't been aware. But the sense of self is not permanent. It's just an impermanent thing. So what's permanent, or it's always there, is that sense of presence. Have you ever been absent? You're always there. I mean, even your daydreams. It's like... There's always consciousness, but we don't identify with consciousness. We identify with thought and with the dreams and the definitions and so on. And so the kind of wisdom practice is saying, or mindfulness and clear comprehension, life is just this way now. And so the reflections of change help you do that. So if I'm feeling fed up or tired or something, and I reflect, oh, fed up feels this way and it's changing, and I look at its changing nature, then that takes me back here. And, oh, this is changing. I have to kind of recede from it rather than attach to it. Contemplation of change. And that also leads you to the sense, well, it's not really mine. It's something happening. It's going on in this stream of consciousness. Make sense? It's a wonderful contemplation, actually. It really is. Because what it says is that potentially every moment has this entry to freedom, always. It's not. Like, you can't become aware. That, you know, if you think about it, and, you know, you start thinking and then someone coughs and then there's an end of thought and you're aware. You don't think, I'm going to become aware. You are aware. Where's the become? Well, what happens with the becoming is you think, I shouldn't be thinking. And then you struggle not to think. And you've become the person who thinks they shouldn't be thinking. It's a deadly trap. So that's why we say, like, when someone does cough and the train of thought is interrupted, value that, like really value it. Oh, this is it. I'm here. Now, I could say that's enlightenment, but obviously the kind of levels of realization of this are deeper and deeper, but it is the entry point. It is the entry point. And then to actually appreciate that moment, this is it, and open to it rather than think, oh God, I'm thinking again. Oh God, my practice is down the tube. And then you've been reborn as a person whose practice is down the tube. You just don't go there. And that's hard to do because we're so judgmental and so on. So, and just like, I would suggest, just trust that. Like, even if for the whole 45 minutes it seems like you were in China, right? You were just totally lost. It seemed that way. And the bell rings. As soon as you notice presence, I say, oh, great. And just be present. Just savor that. Value that. Make that strong. And you'll find that begins to resonate with you. You begin to notice that more and more because that's always there. And then the attachment to the rim, to the thoughts and all that, that begins to fall away. More and more thought is seen as an object, emotions are seen as objects coming and going.